I feel on top of the mountain. I really do. And I'm continuing to grow on a daily basis. And it's the small victories, like sitting with one of my children this morning on my front porch drinking coffee, that feels like, gosh, I can't describe this. I used to think it was, you know, in my 20s, I hiked Machu Picchu and I was like, there, God's there. And, you know, in order to have this transformative experience, I've got to go do. And they were awesome experiences, but I'm noticing so much, like this moment here with you in this room, driving in my car and listening to music and feeling blessed and overwhelmed with joy. I mean, those are the moments that really touch me today.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. This is Dr. John Duffy. Hope you have found the right spot. As always, I so appreciate you protecting time to share this space for myself and my guests. To that end, I have somebody really interesting with me here today. So by and large, if you've been listening to the podcast, you've heard me talk to a lot of people who are 20 years old or 18 or 16. Today, I have a colleague in here. I have a clinician who has a remarkable story to tell. So Kelly Kitley, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me, John.
Well, thanks for being here. Okay, so I guess I would love to go back in time a little bit and start at the beginning. You're a clinician now. You have your own practice called
Serendipitous Psychotherapy.
Serendipitous Psychotherapy. I like that, man. Thanks. There's a reason you call it that. We'll get to that. All right, cool. How did you get into this work in the first place? You know, I think we'll both agree, this is a ridiculous job to have, right? People don't do this kind of thing, right? Yeah. How did you get into this kind of work in the first place?
Well, I had great training from my family of origin. And when I was 16 years old, I was being treated for an eating disorder on Michigan Avenue. And my mom would drive me down every week. And I had an amazing experience with this clinician. And when I graduated high school, I said, that's exactly what I want to do. I want to be a clinician on Michigan Avenue, helping women, and I'm living my dream.
It sounds like it.
Yeah.
It sounds like it. 16 years old, mm-hmm. being treated for an eating disorder.
Yeah.
Brutal. Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I work with a lot of kids that age, and always so heartbreaking and difficult to get past. You mind telling us a little bit about the process back
sure,
when you were a kid?
Sure. Yeah. So it was pretty classic in terms of parents were in the middle of a divorce, substance abusing family, grew up above a bar in Lincoln Park. And it was just something that, you know, addiction runs high in my family.
Yeah.
And it was a coping mechanism for me to manage and control. And it was very secretive. My dad didn't know I was in treatment, so my mom would drive me and pay cash. And
no kidding. Is that right?
Yeah.
Your dad did not know.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
I know.
And your mom would pay
cash.
And
made it hard. And made it hard. I mean, he came to one session after several months of treatment and just blew up in the middle of the therapy session and said the therapist was creating all the problems. And I was like, somebody's advocating for me, the therapist.
Uh-huh.
But he walked out and never came back. But it felt so good to have somebody advocating for me.
Yeah. Is that what the therapy was for you, by and large, just having an advocate?
Oh, absolutely. And a reparative parental experience as
yeah,
well.
Yeah. Such an underrated experience, right? I can tell.
Yeah.
How long were you in treatment then?
2 years, and saw a nutritionist and a psychiatrist, and that was just the beginning.
Was it?
It sure was. I've overcome a lot of adversity in my life.
You so. Have?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you mind telling us a little bit more of your story? Kelly has a book coming out, so I don't want to let's not spoil every moment of it, but if you don't mind telling us the broad strokes, a little bit about what brought you here, I would
sure.
love to hear it.
Sure. So I've kept a journal. That was part of my treatment since I was 12, actually. And
wow.
I'm 38 and I still write very frequently. And it was very cathartic and a healing process. So I always knew I wanted to write a book. And had come across a bin in my basement of every journal I've ever had. And so when I got sober 3.5 years ago, I went through every journal and highlighted themes. And after I recovered from an eating disorder and went off to college, I binge drank a lot in college and had no clue what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be a therapist, but really went to party. And so my parents paid for me to go to a private Catholic college, you know, $30,000. And when my parents divorced, my dad said, I will not pay for college anymore. So I took a year off and did an AmeriCorps program and volunteered in San Jose, California with a program called City Year. And when I was there, I earned a $4,275 scholarship at the end of my 10 months of volunteering, and took that money and moved back to Chicago and went to University of Illinois and bartended.
Bartended?
Did.
Really?
So I was able to pay for my college education in cash.
Wow.
So using that scholarship and then getting into the Jane Addams College of Social Work at University of Illinois, and then bartending and studying. But in my undergrad studies, I was sexually assaulted in Lakeview on Southport. And so it was like I had recovered from this eating disorder. I'd gone back to college. I was feeling great. And then it was, you know, my publisher calls me the female Rocky. It was like then I was knocked down again.
Yeah.
And did group therapy and individual therapy again. And that just created even more of a passion for the work that I wanted to do.
Right.
And it was because of those services and rape victim advocates that came to the hospital and helped me that just really kept continuing my focus in women's mental health. And then went on and got my graduate degree after working in the field and in child welfare for a few years.
Got it.
And went back and got my master's in social work.
Was it that traumatic experience, that sexual assault on Southport, is that part of the reason you want to work with women?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it's, you know, I'm trying to break the silence. That's really my goal. So much of what I've gone through is so shameful.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of stigma attached to it. And people don't talk about it. And for me, in my healing process, I talked to, my healing was talking to other women who had survived.
Got it. Got it. There's something I feel inclined to point out. There's a dissonance just in talking to you, to meet you and to see you, one would not guess. I think that, oh, wow, this woman's been through an awful lot of difficulty. And I suppose the message, and I'm kind of curious to hear what your thoughts are, is don't presume anything about anybody, right? Because everybody's suffering something, everyone's been through something. Mm-hmm. But you know, like in a way, I'm hearing your story, I'm hearing it for the first time, and it's jaw-dropping. I'm like, wow, I'm so sorry, you've been through so much trauma. We've only been talking a few minutes.
Yeah.
Would you agree? Do you feel like we get presumptuous and we assume like, mm-hmm. well, here's Kelly. She seems all put together and mm-hmm. fine. And mm-hmm. and so she must be okay.
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, that's my message because I struggled internally and nobody knew. And even to this day, people will say, oh, you don't have a drinking problem. You drink like all of us. Or, you know, I never saw you drinking at noon. And no, that's not my story. I mean, yes, I did drink. I did drink like many people in my life, family and friends, which was socially and, you know, blacked out a lot. And everybody just assumed, you know, I have 4 kids, I'm successful, I am high functioning, how could I have a problem?
Right.
And that kept me sick for a long time because I minimized it. I never got a DUI, I never went to jail, I, you know, didn't hit rock bottom as many addicts do. And so that's why I am speaking about my experience, strength, and hope.
I so honor your willingness to speak about it, for one thing, and you are to me, and as a clinician, I think you'll share this. To me, you're the scariest kind of person in a way, because when you're suffering either addiction or an eating disorder, maybe depression, maybe anxiety, you stay in a lane, right? In other words, it's the people that you can tell are so far afield, aren't functioning well, and it's like, oh, okay, clearly you need treatment.
Yeah.
And you were able to stay in this spot where it's like, okay, I'm a mom, I'm functioning, I'm working, I'm doing everything that looks right, and so nobody's the wiser, right?
Yeah.
Frightening.
Very.
Yeah.
And I just kind of floated along. You know, I'm high achieving. So that was the touchstone of you're okay. You know, I mean, I'm a marathon runner. Alcoholics don't get up
right.
at 5 a.m. and go for a run.
Right.
You know, even though I was out drinking all night, you know. So it was this high functioning piece that to the world I looked fine.
Yeah.
But internally I hated myself. I hated what I was doing. There was just like a lot of internal suffering.
Yeah. Yeah. To cut to the chase a little bit, why are you willing to be here? Why are you willing to write that book? Why are you willing to tell this story? We've both been to graduate school where we have been instructed in one way or another, well, if you're going to be a clinician, you want to be a bit of a mirror. You don't want to share too much of yourself. How did you decide, I think I'm going to go a different way on that?
I feel like I didn't have another option, you know?
Yeah.
So much of my life is, and I get tearful just thinking about it, like I am at a point where, yes, I have achieved a lot, but it feels differently in these last 3.5 years of sobriety, that it feels like, yes, I have been through so much, but with sobriety, it's like, okay, I'm finally getting it. Like, it's consistent and I'm grateful and, I just want to share that. I mean, I'd want to give it away. I want to inspire other people to change. And I just feel an awesome responsibility to do that.
I can tell.
Yeah.
I can tell. It's palpable in this moment. Kelly, do you feel like you're in the middle of a process, at the end of a process, at the beginning of a process? Where do you feel like you are in terms of healing?
Mm. Well, I'm a work in progress.
And, as we all are, I hope.
Yes. But I feel on top of the mountain. I really do. And I'm continuing to grow on a daily basis. And it's the small victories, like sitting with one of my children this morning on my front porch drinking coffee, that feels like, gosh, I can't describe this. I used to think it was, you know, in my 20s, I hiked Machu Picchu and I was like, there, God's there. And, you know, in order to have this transformative experience, I've got to go do. And they were awesome experiences, but I'm noticing so much like this moment here with you in this room, driving in my car and listening to music and feeling blessed and overwhelmed with joy. I mean, those are the moments that really touch me today.
You know, first of all, that's lovely and so cool to hear. Do you feel like everybody has that capacity for joy? I mean, I'm thinking about like other people I've worked with, young people who've been through a lot, maybe even less than you've been through, and carry what feels like a degree of hopelessness, like this is never gonna change. I'm never gonna feel that joy. I'm never gonna feel like I'm at the top of the mountain. Do you feel like that is open to everybody, or do you feel like, I carry something different in my mind and in my soul that allows me to get there?
I think everybody has it. They just need to tap into it, which is part of why I wanna share my experience, because it is contagious. And I choose to surround myself with people who have that energy, because we support one another and it just amplifies the experience.
Yeah, yeah. You're a marathoner.
Yes.
How did you decide to run, and what does it mean to you? I'm always curious about this. You know, like people would argue, a lot of people I know would say that is a particular type of self-torture that I wouldn't choose. But you're smiling as you talk about it.
Yeah. Well, that's evolved too. I ran my first marathon at 20, you know, when this constant struggle with my addiction, where I would give up drinking for 40 days of Lent or give up drinking during marathon training. And that was, if I could prove to myself that I could go for so long without drinking, it was just, well, you don't have a problem. And so in college, it was something that kept me focused, and I became a marathon coach for the Leukemia Society through Team in Training, and qualified for Boston, and really it became obsessive, and I was very competitive with myself. And I ran my last marathon 8 years ago, and I'm running the Chicago Marathon this year because it means something different to me. I lost a friend of mine from muscular dystrophy in January, and so I'm running in her honor, and raised $3,000 through, I mean, social media is amazing. I posted something, and in 48 hours, I raised $3,000.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
yeah, that is amazing. That's awesome.
And it's a tribute to Megan and who she was and the message that she carried. And now I run slower. I run with my kids riding their bike next to me. I meet random people on the lakefront and strike up conversation. And so it's enjoyable.
Yeah.
It really is. And it's because I've shifted my mind frame.
Got it. Do you feel like in the years since you've been healing, especially the 3.5 years of sobriety, which, by the way, is a massive accomplishment, I know, and I've got addiction in my family, and I think most people listening can say somewhere in their family tree, yeah, there's somebody who is addicted to something. Do you feel like you've got a different level of consciousness than you had before? Do you feel like you're more aware of your surroundings, of the people around you, of connecting with people?
Almost to a fault. I wish I didn't know so much.
Is that right?
I've got to turn it off sometimes, you know? I mean, and that has changed and evolved too. I mean, I'm a caretaker by nature. And
yeah,
so when people are suffering, I want to help, and I'm not that powerful. And so I can do the best that I can. And there are still people in my family with active addiction, and I try to just be a living example, where before I would be like, we got to change them. We got to fix, we got to have an intervention. And I'm not so concerned about that. People have to take personal responsibility. And so I think just carrying my message with the life that I lead, hopefully that will inspire somebody to change.
And if I can ask, what's it like to get together with your family now, especially with that going on? You know what I mean? Like, I work with a lot of people, and I am a person who, when I get together with my family at times, it's like, here we go, like, fire up for this, because not everybody's functioning very well, and you're a therapist, and that you're going to want to change them somehow. How do you manage that part?
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you can relate to that.
Oh, yeah.
I am the oldest of five. My husband is one of five, so we have these big families that get together, and, you know, I love it because I have a different... I used to stress out about it because I would drink so much in those situations to handle those situations. And now, like, I can take breaks and I can disengage and I can wash dishes and I can, you know, play with the kids. And I remember everything the next day. So that feels really good. But, you know, I am never the one to judge anybody in those situations.
Right.
You know, I mean, I have concern for some people, but I try to turn my clinician brain off, which is tough sometimes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And just be a layperson.
A regular human being.
Yes.
How tricky. You know, I carry this theory that addiction never stands on its own. That always there's some element of family strife or depression or anxiety or some combination of all of that, mm-hmm, that underlies it. And I don't know if you share that thought. But if you do, what replaces, you know, in the last few years, what replaces what drinking did for you?
Relationships and connection. I think part of the reason I drank, other than having the addictive gene, of course,
sure, right,
was because I was stressed all the time and I was anxious and I had 4 kids in 8 years and not one to typically ask for help, and so I was trying to hold it together. And now I've created this community that does help me, and that I can be real and authentic. And for a long time, I just wore this mask and tried to hold it together, and drinking gave me a relief and a release. And now I find different ways, and I try not to get myself that stressed out that I need that release.
I would imagine being kind of very good at hiding some of the difficulties, that in a way you had to come out. Like, you know, you had to tell your husband and your friends, and, you know, what was that process like?
Well, with addiction specifically, people thought I was just being too hard on myself. And, you know, I just needed to watch it, and I didn't have to give it up completely. Well, I'd been watching it since my first blackout at 12. So I was very aware. I mean, my mom has been sober 25 years.
Wow.
So she was a living example for me, but didn't do program stuff and had her own path. And so I kept trying to do that. You know, she said God was her sponsor, and I kept trying, you know, I tried every possible self-help book, cleanse, not drinking beer and drinking wine. At one point I drank tequila because that's supposed to like give you more energy. So I tried it all.
You researched.
I researched. Yes. I tried moderation management, and you know, at the end of the day I was just so glad. My best girlfriend growing up stopped drinking 2 months before I did. And she had something that I wanted. And so we've been sober together, which has helped immensely.
That's amazing. You are the mother of four children. How old are your kids?
10, 8, 6, and 4.
Now, because I come from an addictive family as well, I kind of always look sideways at my son, my nieces, my nephews, making sure in the back of my brain that these people are going to be okay. And you know, kind of wanting to kind of support them in a different way than maybe we were supported a generation ago. Mm-hmm. Are you very vigilant as a mother, given what you've been through?
Absolutely. I mean, 1 in 4 of my kids, that's the likelihood that somebody will have addiction. And their understanding, I've educated them at a young age. You know, I remember I used to drink this skinny girl margarita.
All right.
And my daughter called it Barbie girl margarita and said, I can't wait till I can drink that. And she was 4, you know, because it looked really nice. And now they know that I'm allergic to alcohol and
nice.
I can't drink it. And they know as much as I've educated them. Which, yeah, I do. I mean, anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, it runs heavy.
Yes, right.
in the genes.
You probably do the same. I talk to lots of groups of parents, and one anxiety I get is, boy, if I talk to my kids about drugs, alcohol, depression, anxiety, there's this power of suggestion, and I'm going to bring something on that wasn't there before.
Yeah.
Especially if I talk to my younger kids, so that there must be a magic age. It must be 13 or something like that. Would you argue no? Or earlier, younger, and talk to them openly?
Well, I think they're so observant of behavior, you know, and the biggest component is when I would drink, it was like, oh, well, you can't have a sip of that, you know, and they want it. And now I love that they come up to me at parties and they're like, can I have a sip of your Diet Coke or can I have a sip of your water? Because they know that, you know,
that's safe.
That's safe, yeah. But really, they ask questions, and I practice what I preach. I just try to be real and authentic with them as well, and they ask so many questions. Why can't Dad drink but Mom can't drink? And Dad doesn't act differently when he drinks
right.
like Mom did.
Right.
And unfortunately, you know, my older two remember some bits and pieces that they'll be like, remember when you said you would do this and then the next day you didn't? Those are reminders to me that
sure.
broken promises were a piece of it.
Yeah. How does all this translate into your clinical work, into your job and your passion? Because I always picture like the best of us that do this work have been through something. You know what I mean? I think you can learn certain things in graduate school and certain things you just can't learn, you know? And I suspect your experience is invaluable to your clients. How does it work? How does it translate?
Well, as you said in the beginning, I mean, that we aren't trained to self-disclose.
Right.
I think in the addiction world, it's a little more acceptable because you are showing that you can be sober and still happy, and that's a model. But, you know, most of my clients didn't know a whole lot about me. And now some of them follow me on Facebook and they read some of the articles that I write or that I'm quoted as an expert in. And it has opened up so much dialogue that some people have said, oh my gosh, I just thought you were so perfect. And some people, you know, are like, I'm so happy that I know that you have had issues in your own life and you're not just counseling me based on what you read. And, you know, so I have personal and professional training.
Yeah.
And the personal training has been lifelong.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, my experience is different from my clients. So I never want to say, well, I did this and this worked for me. You know, it's about leading that process. But sometimes they will say, you know, how are you a mom and you don't drink? I mean, gosh, isn't the witching hour horrible? You know, and I think they're interested to know, like, what does that look like?
Right.
Because I might think of doing something like that. And then I can share my experience.
Yeah, yeah. Invaluable. I've got to think it's invaluable. And, you know, what a gift to the profession you are. So if you had to give your TED talk, you know,
which is a professional goal.
Okay, right. So, I'm with you on
thank
that.
Thank you for putting it out in the universe.
Okay, so this we're going to give you a 2-minute rehearsal on your TED talk. What is it you want people to know from the nature of your story, your professional life? What is your, if you had an overriding message or two that you wanted to deliver to anybody listening here, what would you want them to hear?
To find your purpose and to never give up. I think a lot of times people struggle with hopelessness or feeling like I can never. Perseverance is 99% of it. Just getting up, showing up, putting one foot in front of the other, and really there's no limit. There really is no limit. And people have told me no my entire life. And so much of what I aspire to do, I'm doing right now. And that doesn't feel like, well, I told you so. And, you know, look at me now. It's people are going to tell you no. And if you listen to that, you're going to stay stuck. But if you keep looking at that vision, you can accomplish whatever you put your mind to.
So many of us stop at no, right? Mm-hmm. Stop at that first no, mm-hmm. instead of persevering through. And those no's are character building. They're critical in a way, right?
30 publishing companies told me no. I mean, I got rejection letter after rejection letter. And I mean, the first couple hurt.
Oh.
And it's not good enough. Nobody wants to read it. What am I doing? And then it just became a game. You know, I'm like, well, somebody's got to say yes. And the way I found the current publishing company, at the time that I found it, it all lined up. And it was just like, wait, you know, I'm impulsive by nature, so I like to hear yes right away.
Right.
But this has taught me a lot of patience.
Yeah.
And that it kind of works out the way it's supposed to work out.
That's awesome. And congratulations.
Thank you.
How do we find you? How do we find your stuff? How are we going to find your book when it comes out?
Sure. So it's available on pre-order now. And if you go to my website, kellykitley.com, K-E-L-L-E-Y, Kitley, K-I-T-L-E-Y.com, you can order directly from the website. And I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And this is all, social media is new to me in the last year and a half. So it has been quite a ride.
That's awesome. And the name of your book is?
Myself.
I wish I had stolen that name. I love that so much. So that's awesome. I cannot wait to read it. So follow Kelly Kitley, K-E-L-L-E-Y, K-I-T-L-E-Y, all over the place. She is going to be somebody you're going to be hearing from. You can find this podcast on iTunes, on WGN Plus, on Podbean, and on Stitcher. There is a parenting video series that's free on my website, drjohnduffy.com. And if you have any thoughts, questions, comments, or if you'd like to be a guest on this podcast, just drop me an email at johngduffy@aol.com. I know that's old school. And once again, on behalf of Kelly Kitley and myself, I appreciate your time, and I will talk to you next time. Thanks so much.